We're going to go ahead and get started now. We are very lucky to have with us today Dan Evans, Fred Clair, and Jenna Boyer on our GM panel. I will introduce them as briefly as I think I can. Dan Evans, who I last saw, I think, 17 years ago or 16 years ago when he worked with the White Sox, and I worked at Stats Inc. Great to see you again, Dan. Dan joined the White Sox as an intern while a college junior, wound up with spending 20 years with the White Sox, later as the assistant general manager. Dan left the White Sox, worked for the Cubs for about a year in broadcasting and as in baseball operations, then was hired as the GM of the Dodgers. That was 2002 and 2003, I believe, your two full years. In Dan's 2 years, he drafted James Loney, Jonathan Broxton, James McDonald, Russell Martin in the 17th round, impressive pick, Chad Billingsley and Matt Kemp. So the fruits of those drafts you can obviously still see today. After Dan left, the very next year, the Dodgers won 93 games in their first division title in 9 years. From 2004 to 2007, Dan worked with the Mariners in the front office, then with an agency, Paragon Sports International, and now he runs Evans Baseball Consulting. Fred Clair, interesting history. Fred was a writer, Southern California native, moved here when he was in high school, I believe. Is that right, Fred? Worked for a number of newspapers, got a job with the Dodgers in their PR department in 1969. 1975, became the VP of Public Relations. Was on a nice PR career path, I think. And then something happened in 1987. Al Campanis, Nightline. Some of us in this room remember that all too well. And Fred Clair became the Dodgers general manager, April of 1987. The next winter, Fred remade the Dodgers roster, brought in Kirk Gibson, most notably, Alfredo Griffin, Jesse Orosco, Jay Howell, and of course the Dodgers won the World Series in 1988. I think it's safe to say that if Fred Clair hadn't made those moves, that would not have happened. Fred served as the Dodgers GM until 1998. Today he writes the occasional column for MLB.com, has written a wonderful book which I highly recommend called Fred Clair, My 30 Years in Dodger Blue. And he also works with USC and Long Beach State on their sports management programs. Jed Hoyer, I'm not sure if this should go last or first, but he is the all-time leader in saves at Wesleyan University. You would not expect that from a man of his stature, but there are some. Think Billy Wagner, right? Same stuff, basically?
Tim Collins,
better. Jed, of course, is right now the executive VP and GM of the San Diego Padres. Jed joined the Red Sox front office in 2002, became an assistant GM, in 2005. Jed, I think, is one of the few people in history who's ever been a co-general manager, which lasts for, I think, 10 weeks, is that right? Must have been, he could probably just tell stories about that for an hour. I wish we had more time. Jed is also a big part of a famous little bit of baseball history. He and Theo Epstein visited Curt Schilling in the famous Thanksgiving visit in 2003, and of course that may well have changed baseball history in a significant way. I don't know if Jed can talk about that today, but I'm sure there's a great story there too. And of course, in October 2009, Jed was hired as the Padres general manager, a job he holds today. Flip to the questions. First question is probably the toughest question, because you may not have been asked this question before. I have to imagine that as a general manager and the public face of a franchise, the person who all successes are. You get a lot of success, credit for the success, there's a lot of blame for the failures. You must feel a great responsibility to not only the organization and your players, but also the fans, the whole community. And I'm hoping that each of you can speak to that a little bit. I don't want to say there's a great weight there, but I don't know. I'd like to know what your thoughts are. Dan, could you start us off, please?
Well, I think for me, it was a little different. Simply because I left the Cubs and I came to the Dodgers, and Don Drysdale had really been a mentor for me with the White Sox, and I had heard the great things about the Dodgers for years and really looked at the Dodgers as the model organization in the game. There had been some tough times in Los Angeles prior to me coming in, and I felt that I had to come in and kind of go back to the way that Fred, Al Campanis, Branch Rickey, some of the great people in Dodger history did it, and really respect the franchise's past. So for me, Rob, it's a great point. I did feel that responsibility, and I also felt a responsibility to the fans, because when people are coming to the ballpark in droves like they did at Dodger Stadium during that period, I felt a distinct responsibility to give them the best product I possibly could and always be respectful for the great history of the franchise.
Brett?
Rob, I think responsibility is the key word, because it was what I felt from the day that I first was asked to take the position in 1987 until the day that I was fired in 1998. And I really felt that each and every day what I wanted to do was to give the best of what I had to give, because I never wanted to look back or think that what might have been different if I hadn't given everything that I had to give. That was the type of athlete that I had been, maybe not a very good one, but one that just totally wanted to give it all. And the other thing I wanted to do was to accept the responsibility, because Rob mentioned, I believe, Nightline, and when Al Campanis was asked to resign in the 1987 season after the third game in Houston, and Peter and I were getting on a plane to fly back to Los Angeles, Peter called me from the airport, and he didn't ask me, he said, Fred, you have to take this job. And when I went into his office the next morning before opening day, I said, Peter, I will take the job, but I take it under, I said, if you want to form a committee, you want me to be a part of the committee, I'm happy to do that. But I said, if you're asking me to take this job, I take it only under one condition. And he said, what is that? And I said, I want full, total, complete responsibility. And he looked at me, stuck out his hand, and said, you got it, because I wanted to be sure that if I was going to be run out of town or fired, it was for my decisions. And I guess ultimately that's what happened.
it's a really good question. And I was this morning I woke up and I started debating whether I wanted to read a book I'm reading right now or focus on some of the things we're looking at job-wise. And I sat there and felt tremendous guilt and ended up focusing on work. And it's Saturday morning, and it's hard to find that that levity or that relaxation time, even though sometimes getting away from the job for a while and then kind of refocusing later is the right thing to do. I think that's an example of the responsibility that all of us feel, that I didn't feel like I was sort of deserved to read a book after last night's game, and felt like, these are big decisions that we may have coming up soon and I need to really focus on. So I think it weighs on you all the time. A big part of why I'm a New England kid, and I left the Red Sox to go to San Diego, and a big part of why I did that was, it's a city that's never had a championship, and the desire to bring a championship to San Diego would be incredible. 98, they lost in the World Series, and people still talk about it in San Diego the way they talk about 2004 in Boston. So I can only imagine how people would feel if they won. So that's really the goal. But along that path, as we try to build that, there's going to be ups and downs. But I can tell you that. Now, however hard you guys imagine we might take those low periods or take that responsibility, is probably even more than I probably would have imagined before I took the job. It's something that you train for and you want to do, but it's a real responsibility. It's something that I think all of us take really seriously.
This is sort of a related question. I was wondering if you could start us off. I know you have a story, Chad, about how sometimes the job and your personal lives, it's hard to make those fit together when you basically have 24/7 jobs all year round.
Well, the story I was telling earlier was, because right now we're playing the Dodgers right now, or shockingly we're scoreless through six, so it's a pillow fight again. I was telling these guys, I didn't want to know the score, it'll distract me, and I was, last year I got married during the season, and we planned the wedding. I'm an assistant GM for the Red Sox, and figured it wasn't a big deal to kind of get a weekend away. And then I took the job in San Diego and talked to ownership, and they said it was okay that I had this mid-June wedding. And we were actually playing a game during my wedding, and I did not want to know the score. I didn't have my phone on me. I didn't want to be distracted. It was her day. So I was walking into the reception, didn't know anything, and it was a really good feeling. And actually, we're facing Josh Johnson, so I wasn't expecting that the outcome would be all that great. And as I was walking into the reception, Theo looked at me, and he's like, 2-1. About to be introduced, and next thing you know, I know the score, and now I'm distracted because I'm thinking Adam's probably in the game, and hopefully we'll hang on. And so it is 24/7. There's no way around it. I think that you, luckily, I was already in a role of responsibility with the Red Sox when I met my wife, and she understands it. But I think all of us depend on having spouses that are understanding. Because it is a lot, in this role, and one could even make an argument that the job should be split up at this point. It becomes so vast, but you've got all the minor league players, you've got your major league system, you've got the media, you've got all these things going on. It is a 24/7 job, and we do depend on people being pretty understanding.
It's 24/7 year round, so it doesn't matter whether you get married during the season or during the off season. As a matter of fact, my wedding was held up due to a contract negotiation with Fernando Valenzuela. I think Sid Thrift may have given the best description. He once said to me, he said, "Fred, do you know what the description of a general manager is?" And I said, "Well, I think I've got an idea, but tell me, Sid, your view." And he said, "The blinking red light in your hotel room is never off." And there's a lot to be said for that. But it does take the commitment that it takes to do the job. I think that a couple things are very important. You're very fortunate, as I was, to have a tremendous wife in Cheryl and great family support, and that meant so much to me. And she was an athlete herself and understood competing, and I don't think I could have devoted all the time that I did if I had not had that type of understanding and that support from Cheryl and my family. So that becomes incredibly important to know that support is there, because it literally is, again, it's not the season, the off season. It is all year round, every day, and you have to be consumed by it. Ted mentions that, can the job be split? From a practical standpoint, somebody can make that case, but emotionally you could never do it, because you have to be totally dedicated to it. And I think the other thing that I always try to do is take responsibility for what you do, because in baseball there's a lot of he said, they said, I was told, that it doesn't, none of that matters. If you're fortunate to be a general manager and you have the responsibility, accept that responsibility at all times.
I agree, both of them. It really comes down to having a supportive family and in also supportive ownership. I was so lucky. I met a woman who was a TV sports producer for ESPN, so she had just as stupid a schedule as I did, sometimes even worse. And I think because she understood, it made a lot of sense. I had tremendous ownership in Bob Graziano and Bob Daly. They were phenomenal to me. But I'll tell you a quick story just to put things in perspective. My wife was 9 months and 10 days pregnant with our second child, and we were in the 93 championship series against the Toronto Blue Jays. We had the bases loaded, nobody out. This is before cell phones. And I had a pager on, and Pat Gillick, my good friend with the Blue Jays, had a car waiting for me to take me to the airport if my wife went into labor. And the deal was, if I got up from my seat in the middle of the game, "Hello, Pat, I need help." Well, my wife paged me with the bases loaded, nobody out, and I thought, all right, well, I got to get up, I got to go. I run up the stairs, I go downstairs, and I call from the trainer's room, and my wife says, "Oh, come on, we got to score a run here, I'm going to win." So literally, I was a veteran, I already had one, but I said, "Honey, are you serious? I mean, this is why you're calling me?" She said, "Yeah, now there's two outs and still bases loaded." And I went, "Oh my God." So I said, Sue, so you're not going into labor? She says, don't worry, I'm not going to go into labor. Stephanie Ventura, Robin's wife, and I have already decided we're probably both going to pop on the off day between games 5 and 6. So go back and enjoy the situation. So the driver of the Blue Jays was all excited. He had my bags in the car, and I said, false alarm, number 2's not here yet. We ended up winning the ball game, and oh, did the guys give me a hard time, because they all saw me run up into the backs of the stands, and they all said, what, you're putting us before your family? I said, no, we'll get to us. Let's win this first.
Well, that's a great segue, Dan, because I want to get in your heads a little bit more about what it's like when every game seems like life and death. Whether it's, you know, the pennant race, Jed, last season, I was in San Francisco, I saw it all, and I'm sure you were there too. And Fred and Dan, you've both been involved in postseason situations. The players get to play, the manager commands, all you can basically do at that point is watch. The moves are over, there's really nothing you can do. What's that like, Dan?
It's very frustrating, because as all three of us know, you always feel like you can do something. And suddenly, not only can you not do anything, but you really can't do anything. There's no minor leagues to go run to. You are just having the toughest time in the world. I found that's when I really appreciated how much I love the sport, because I could get so into the game and come down and talk to our coaching staff and talk to our manager and really feel like what was going on. I got great advice when I took the game. I took the job. John Scherholz is a great friend and a mentor for me. And John said to me, Danny, just appreciate the game. Don't ever lose your love of the game, and appreciate you can make a difference, but you can't always do it at the moment that you're at the game. And I just backed off and watched it, and as these guys know, it's very frustrating, but you know what? That's where you want to be every year. You want the games to count in September.
Brett?
Rob, it really goes beyond playoff games or late season games, because the intensity of the game, I don't care whether it's April, May, June, the importance and the intensity of a game, because you don't know how that game will play into the total picture, is immense. And that's why I think that you have to look at every game, of every play, and recognize the importance of that. And if you had a player or players that you felt weren't focused in that manner, it just seemed to me that they weren't the right players for us, because you don't know how it's going to play out. And that's why, you know, people used to ask me about whatever criticism that would come my way or the team's way. I said, you know what, that's not even on my scale. I don't even, that compared to the outcome of last night's game, you can't measure those things. It has no meaning compared to the feeling that you have when you lost a game. And since having left the team, people would say to me, Fred, you look a lot better than you did when you were the general manager. I said, what have I got to worry about now? I used to worry 24 hours a day.
Yeah, a little different note. I mean, for me, every game, you end up in these jobs and you do this because you love the game and because you're competitive, and every night you want to win, and you know, I've broken more than my share of phones and stuff like that. So I mean, certainly there is a frustration level, but at the same time, I always think that it's like watching, like you can't go up and down with your team. It's like watching an individual stock, and so I try to watch every game and focus on parts of the game, how individual players are doing, thinking about it. But I do find that if you go up and down with the team every single day, It's not an effective way to manage. It's not an effective way to look at your team. So I always try to bring myself back to, you know, looking at 10 game increments, looking at 30 game increments, and doing things like that. So that way, I don't go up and down. You don't want to sign a guy to a long term contract because he threw 7 shutout innings, and you don't want to dump a guy because he had a bad start. And you always have to bring it back to bigger increments, because one game is like watching an individual stock on a given day, and that part's really hard because we can't make decisions that way.
Jed, what was that last weekend like for you last season, though?
It was part of it was we had 4 games at home against the Cubs, and we lost 3 out of 4, including a really bad 1-0 loss on the our last home game. So we went up to San Francisco. I guess we were down two when we went up there. So in some way, we knew we had to win three in a row. We had to win three in a row to force a playoff game. And meanwhile, Atlanta was playing. So in some ways, we were so frustrated by this Cubs series and going up there and then winning those first two. It was like, this would be a great story, almost like 2004 coming back against the Yankees. It was a sense of exuberance the last week. Can we do this? But it was caused by really being ineffective in a couple weeks before that. So the whole thing was, it was a wonderful ride for us. I think that we most certainly got the most out of our talent. I don't think that was a team that anyone expected to win 90. I think we were expected to win the low 70s. So it was a great ride. But it was hard because when things started going south in September, to their point about having no control, you can't make trades, you can't do anything. You're watching and you feel helpless, but I also feel like I should be able to do something, or I should have done something that would stop this slide, because we really were in a position we should have won the division, and we let it slip away, and we almost tried to climb back at the end. So the last weekend was exciting, but the 30 days before that were incredibly frustrating.
So now we shift into the inside baseball segment of the panel. I'd like each of you to come up with one move that worked really, really well for your club. And you know what the next question is going to be, by the way. But first, one worked really, really well. And as briefly as you can, how it came together. Dan?
Well, I'm going to start off. I just want to introduce somebody. Dick Kramer is one of the great pioneers of our sport. Dick, could you stand up for a moment? Dick put together... together a program, guys, 30 years ago that charted pitch-by-pitch sequences of games, and that's why I wanted to call attention to them. I had just started with the White Sox, and we had a computer system that we traveled. Doug Melvin, who's the general manager of the Brewers, myself, and Jay Albus, who's now the vice president of PR for the Rockies. The three of us had pretty interesting teams that went out and tried to do this back in the early 80s. And I'm shagging fly balls in the old Comiskey Park, and a couple players came over to me and said, do you realize how many fly balls are caught at the track versus how many balls go out for our club? And I went, yeah. And he said, no, seriously, I think it's lopsided. So I was 22 years old, 21 years old, and I called Dick. And I said, Dick, you know what? I think this guy's right. So I put together this study, and we were talking about moves. This was a move. And it was scary because I went into Jerry Reinsdorf, who's the great owner of the White Sox and a tremendous man. He's the owner of the Bulls too. And I pitched him this thing that we had lost 40 more balls to the track than the other team. And if we moved the field 8 feet, that we would have a considerable change in our club. And I could do it because of the computer program. And he said to me, well, let me table it. How much did you think? And I said, well, I think we could put some seats in with the 8 feet goes out, maybe atone for the money. And I'm scared to death. I'm thinking, this isn't a 300-level college class here. I was just literally ending my internship. And he brought me in a couple days later, and he said, Danny, we're going to do it. Well, the following year, we set a club record for home runs. We set a record for attendance. We scored more runs. We scored 800 runs that year. And at that point, I realized that you can take this wonderful team that plays in front of you every day and do something really big and really constructive if you just put your mind to it. So, Dick, to this day, I thank you. But it's just a fascinating thing every day, guys. You know, we all sit there and watch games, but we could actually do something about it. And nothing I ever did as a general manager or as an assistant ever compared to what I did there, because that's the ballpark I grew up going to, and all of a sudden, you know, it was 8 feet closer to the wall.
Fred?
Well, let's see, I think your question related to player. Did you say player moves?
Sure.
Yeah. I think that one, there are obviously a number of moves in 12 or 13 years to general manager, but move that kind of stays in my mind is one of the first trades that I made. I become the general manager. We had a young man in center field by the name of Mike Ramsey. As you guys probably know, there probably must have been 8 guys named Mike Ramsey who played professional Major League Baseball. But we were in Montreal. I just become the general manager in April, and this was probably a late April early May game, and there was a ball hit to center field that I felt that Ramsey should have caught. He didn't catch, totally misplayed. I'd seen him do that once or twice before. And when the writers went to him and asked him about that play, he said, "You expect me to catch everything?" And when I read that quote, I thought in my mind, yeah, I do. You know, you're going to tell me about the Dodgers. I expect you to catch everything that's catchable. So I started focusing on who we might acquire. Had never made a significant trade. Had signed Mickey Hatcher as my first move as a Major League General Manager. And I focused on a guy playing for Baltimore. Actually, he was with the Rochester Club. His name is John Shelby. And I had one of our scouts go in and look at John in Rochester. This is early in the season. It's cold. He's been sent down by the Orioles. He's had experience at the major league level. But the scout said, "Freddie, this guy really prepares. He really plays hard." He said, "I think this guy could help us. He runs everything out. He's a good defensive ball player. He's a switch hitter." He said it seems to be struggling a little bit, but I like his I like the action of his bat. He said, "I think that he can hit." So I don't want to prolong this too much, but I was talking to Hank Peters, who was the general manager of the Orioles, and I was going to trade Tom Niedenfuhr. And we were in Atlanta at the time. We were headed towards to New York, but I told Tommy, and this just shows you what can happen or not happen related to a trade. I told Tommy before this last game of Atlanta, I said, "Tommy, whatever you do, don't pitch Niedenfuhr, because I've got a deal for a center fielder that I think can help us." So he said, "Okay." So I said, "We need help with center field." I said, "I've got a guy that can catch balls, and I think he can help us." So we're playing in Atlanta, and it goes extra innings. And it's the 11th inning, it's the 12th inning, it's the 13th inning. Casey could say, you could look it up. Niedenfuhr has to come in the ballgame. So the first hitter hits a ball right back to the box. I've seldom seen this happen. It hits the rubber. I thought it had gone off Niedenfuhr's foot. And it goes straight up in the air. And Tommy goes out. It did get part of it. He has to take Niedenfuhr out of the game. Tommy, the small crowd in Atlanta, walks off the field and looks at me like, how was I to know? So finally, I make the deal with Hank Peters. I call John. We're in a Chase Stadium in New York. I called John. I said, "John, we've just made a deal, and I want you to report tonight." And he said, "Oh, Mr. Clare," he says, "you know, I live in an upstairs apartment in Rochester. My wife is here with me." And he said, "It'll take me 2 or 3 days to get to Albuquerque." And I said, "John, you're not going to Albuquerque. You are the starting center fielder of the Los Angeles Dodgers." And I swear, there was silence for a minute. And he said to me, "Mr. Clare, I've waited all my life to hear those words." And John Shelby came over in 1987. And again, as Casey says, you can look it up. I think from May, maybe May the 27th, for the rest of that season, he hit more home runs and drove in more runs than any center fielder in Major League Baseball. And besides all of that, was a wonderful, wonderful guy. So it's just the makeup of a deal that you never know all of the moving parts until it's finally done.
This is a tough one for me because, you know, I don't want to insult anyone or anyone I've recently traded or recently acquired. But I think the biggest thing as far as how it relates to how you sleep at night in a job is, it really comes down to, you know, do you feel good about your process, and do you feel good about how hard you worked to put the deal together, and how hard you worked on the details. And, you know, I can think of a number of deals that didn't work out, whether it was in Boston or San Diego, that to this day I never lose a wink of sleep because the process was right, everything went according to plan, and, you know, we're dealing in human beings. Sometimes things don't work out, and I just always think to myself, you're doing well. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but you know, 60 or 70% of your transactions are working out, you're way ahead of the game. So things are not going to work out. I think it's the deals that come together quickly, where you don't feel like you did enough research, or you lose your first choice at a certain position, and there's a huge drop off, and you sign the second choice guy, even though you have a bad taste in your mouth, and you need to do the deal. And I think that really, as much as we focus on, you know, quantitative measures, focus on our process, I do think that gut feeling on a deal is really important. And, you know, that gut feeling doesn't come from just having seen him play. It comes from all the information, all the details, all the things you've done. And you feel like, okay, this process is right. I feel good about this. You do the deal. And when you have that, if it doesn't work out, you feel fine about it. And I know that's it sounds easy, but, you know, that's all you can do. I think that when any step gets skipped, or when things don't come together in the way you like, or you have a bad feeling and it doesn't work out, those are the ones that make you, you know, keep you up at night and really give you a bad feeling in your stomach.
Well, just to Dan and Fred, could you talk about, Dan, first, a deal that you made that later you regretted? Maybe talk a little bit about why?
Well, the problem you have as a general manager, Rob, is you don't get to second guess yourself. The deal's done. It's over. Once you make that decision, and it's a real sobering fact, the first time you make a trade as a general manager, you know, you hope it works out. But, you know, when you're a fan and when you're an assistant, you don't feel the heat. Mine is easy. When I was going into the 03 season, I got a mandate from ownership that we had to keep our spending at a certain level. And that was about $2.1 million away from what I had committed. So I had no money. I had no money to make the moves that we needed to do. So I tried to talk to my staff, and I said, come up with something. And I know I even talked to Jed at the time, trying to come up with a way to move some money around. And we ended up trading Grudzelanic, and we got Hundley in the deal. And I coun't publicly say that I didn't want Todd Hundley so much, because I couldn't say publicly, as the three of us know, you can never say everything. And I didn't want to tell people that our payroll was like right here and we were at it. So I just said, well, we're looking for some payroll flexibility and maneuverability. But in reality, I couldn't make that trade. I mean, if I didn't make the trade, we didn't have enough money to sign enough players to put 25 guys on the field. So it was one of those deals that internally I just said, guys, listen, I'll take the bullet on this one. I'll pretend like I like it. I don't like it, but I like what we're getting in return, which is an additional $2.5 million. And you know, it's hard because you can't say publicly what you can say privately. And later on, you'd love to be able to say, well, by the way, but well, by the way, doesn't work real well at that point.
Rob, my most regrettable deal, it's not hard to identify. If you saw the Los Angeles Times, I think it was yesterday, they're still reminding me of it how many years later.
That's right.
The trade of Pedro Martinez. And, you know, when you look at that, and I go back, because you have to learn from everything that you do, there were a number of factors that were involved, and I'll say this and say none of it as an excuse, because ultimately the deal is the deal and you should stand on that deal. We, at the time that trade of Pedro was made, I believe that was in November of 1993, one of the things that was not a driving part, but I just want to give this to you as far as the input that you have to, that you should take when you're making a trade. Frank Jobe, at a meeting at the winter meetings that year, or maybe even the previous year, that year I believe, had said to me and to the group of scouts and people that we had, he said, it's public, he's the only reason I would say it now, he said, Fred, he said, the shoulder of Pedro Martinez, I just don't believe will hold up. He said, this is a very frail guy, and he said, I don't think this will hold up. I say that because years later, when I was taking a lot of heat on it, as I did through the years, Frank called me and he said, Fred, why don't you ever mention what I said in that meeting? Because there were a lot of people there. And I said, Frank, look, I could not respect you more as our team doctor. Your job is to give me the best information that you can give me. I said, I did not trade Pedro Martinez because of that report. That was just one factor among a number of factors is the reason that I made that. So I didn't say it then, and I'm not going to say it now, and I'm not going to say it ever, nor would I have ever done that until Frank went public with the LA Times to tell that very story. But when you're making a trade, you have to take all of the information. As I look back as a learning part of that, I so wanted to fill the need at second base, and this is a lesson for anybody who's a general manager. Sometimes you can get so focused on trying to fill a need that you are literally too focused on that as opposed to a better perspective. But the other part of that is that, which I think is critically important to a general manager, is that when you make the move, the thing that you need to do after that, don't say it off the record, don't say it to some press person, I made this deal because this scout told me this, the manager told me that. That is just absolutely BS, because you break down the integrity of your scouts and your people, your evaluators, if you do that type of thing. So that's why that I didn't want any other name connected to any of that, because I believe so strongly for the ongoing relationships to build that type of trust with the people that I rely on.
Well, with that in mind, I'm still going to ask this question, maybe a more general question than I intended. It seems to me that in the public, we don't know enough about the owner-GM relationships and how those influence which moves are made and which ones aren't. And I'm sure there are anecdotally, we know of many moves that a GM wanted to make but was prohibited from making by his owner, or the other thing, a move that an owner forced upon Jim Daniels, sort of alluded to that. I'd like you to talk a little bit about, all three of you if you can, just what that relationship was like and how that's a big part of your job. Sure, Dan.
I think the most important relationship you have is with the owner. And I think it's because you have to get the barometer of how he wants to do business or how he or she wanted to do business. I was very lucky. I've worked for four great franchises in my career thus far. I worked for four terrific people. And as a result, the discourse between the owner and myself was very open and honest, and it was great. And I think, as Fred alluded to earlier, you've got to wear the responsibility. You got to take the bullet, and you got to be okay with that, or else it's the wrong job. You got to be okay with them criticizing you. And as a result, I always just tried to focus on communicating what I was trying to do and why. And are you okay with what I'm doing? I was lucky. Like with the Dodgers, I had great people. They were fantastic. They were trying to sell the club. Some things happened later on with Guerrero that got real complicated, and it was very frustrating for me. But luckily, with Jerry Reinsdorf, with the Mariners, and with the Dodgers, I just had a great situation, and it became a situation that I learned. I think you guys saw Roland Heeman here a couple days ago, who was my first boss. And Roland said, if you can maintain the integrity of the conversation with the owner on a very open and honest situation, he will be there for you when you really need him. And he was dead right, and it was great advice. And I'm happy and lucky that I had people like that to work for.
I experienced the extremes of ownership, starting with the Dodgers and with the ownership of Walter and then Peter O'Malley, because they really should serve as a model for ownership. They placed the responsibility on the people charged with that responsibility. They never second-guessed. They were at their best in the toughest of times in giving support. It was really an ideal situation in every way. Strangely enough, the only time that Peter O'Malley ever questioned anything that I was going to do or did do happened on the first day I became the general manager. I went into Peter's office after opening day. Maybe this was the second day, the first or second day. Bill Madlock was playing third base for us, was injured, and I was going to have to put him on the disabled list, and we needed somebody to come in and play third base. And there was a player that I had identified that I really wanted to add to our team. And so I went in to see Peter. I'm on my first day as the general manager. I've never made a deal. And he said, I said, Peter, there's a move that I want to make. And he said, what is that? And I said, I want to release Jerry Royce and sign Mickey Hatcher. He said, "You want to do what?" I said, "I want to release Jerry Royce and sign Mickey Hatcher." He said, "What do we owe Jerry Royce?" I said, "Slightly over $1 million. He said, "Where's Mickey Hatcher been?" I said, "He just got released by the Minnesota Twins." He said, "So you're telling me you want to release a guy we owe $1 million to and sign a guy that just got released by the Twins?" I said, "Yeah, I think Mickey Hatcher can help us." So he said, "You better go get Sam Fernandez, the lawyer." So I go to get Sam and come back, and he said, "Fred, tell Sam what you want to do." And I told him, and Peter said, "If I were you, I wouldn't do that." He said, "Have you talked to Tommy?" I said, "No, but I've been in all the meetings in spring training. I think that Royce is at the end of the line, and I have no doubt in knowing Mickey, who previously played for us, that he can help us." He said, "Fred, if I were you, I wouldn't do it. But you're the general manager, so you do whatever you want to do." So I'm walking back to my office, and Sam says, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "When I get back to my office, I'm going to release Jerry Royce and sign Mickey Hatcher." And he said, "Holy cow." There's something along, it's holy something. I called Willie Sanchez, Mickey's agent, and got Mickey in for that night's ball game. And he delivered a key hit in that game, and my phone, Mickey flew in from Phoenix, came in, was in uniform, played that night, got a base hit, and the phone rings, and it's Peter, and he said, "That was a great move." So those are memorable parts. I forget the rest of the question.
That was it. Jeff?
I think that, you know, that was one part of the job. I think there's no way you can prepare for. I guess I had a co-GM 40 days, but that was a little different. But there's no way you can prepare for that relationship with ownership. And last year, my first year, we really first place the whole year, and it was sort of a smooth sail. And I remember, you know, we started out with a terrible April, and I remember calling Theo in April and saying, you really don't realize, as assistant GM, I probably could have given you such better advice if I had realized, you know, some of the intricacies of the relationship with ownership. And what I mean by that is, like, I have a terrific relationship with Jeff Morad. He's been terrific, and part of why I took the job was that Josh Burns, who was a friend of mine from Boston, had said he was just a great guy to work for, couldn't recommend him higher. And he's been exactly as advertised. But as much as you want to win for yourself, and we talk about how competitive we are, you want to win so badly for the owner. And, you know, he's... You know, it's his money, it's his group together. It consumes the owners, everybody, as much as it consumes us. And so when you're, you know, 5-12 or whatever your record was, and you're going down the hall to talk to ownership, your feeling of disappointment to them is unbelievable, and something that I never had experienced, never imagined, until you sort of make that walk. Again, the owners own these teams because they're competitive and they've been very successful in business, and they want to win. And you know, when you're not winning, you know, almost before you think of yourself, you think about your, you know, how much you're disappointing them. And it's a strange feeling, and like I said, one you can't really prepare for until you do the job.
Rob, if I might, I mentioned Peter, and I said there were two extremes, and I'm not here to bang News Corp or Fox, but it just shows you what transpired with the Dodgers when the O'Malley's did sell to Fox and News Corp. And as you probably know, News Corp's interest in buying the Dodgers really had to do with television. Rupert Murdoch went on PBS with Charlie Rose when they were going to sell the team and said as much. But it does show the extremes and the impact of ownership, because Fox got into the business for television reasons. They wanted to establish a regional television network, which they ultimately did. But in the process, because they were also trying to gain the television rights for the Florida Marlins, they traded Mike Piazza. And I got a call from Bob Graziano in May of 1998, and he said, "Fred, there's been a trade that's been made that needs to be announced tonight." And he's telling the general manager, "There's been a trade that's been made when there's never been a move that has ever been made during my time, Al Campanis's time, or Buzzy Bavese's time, without the general manager having total control on it." He said, "There's been a trade, and Mike Piazza and Todd Zeal have been traded for Gary Sheffield, Bobby Bonilla, and Jim Eisenreich." that needs to be announced tonight. I said, well, then there'll be two announcements tonight, because after I announce the trade, I'll announce my resignation, because you don't need me. And I went back to my office realizing that my 30 years were now in a totally different light. And I got a call from Derek Hall, our publicity guy, who's now the president of the Arizona Diamondbacks. And he said, Fred, he said, the trade can't be announced tonight. And I said, why is that? He says, Gary Sheffield has a no-trade contract. I said, of course, Gary Sheffield has a no-trade contract. Every general manager in baseball knows that. I assume the Fox executive must know that. No, he didn't know that. And so I didn't resign, because now we had a total mess of a trade that had been made that couldn't be made. And it's really an incredible chapter in baseball history, because Gary Sheffield, the next night, flies to Los Angeles, is in my office at Dodger Stadium while I try to resolve the no-trade clause, and the Florida Marlins are playing the St. Louis Cardinals. This guy is, and they would talk about the importance of a game, which I believe with all my heart, this guy's sitting in my office and not on the bench or in the lineup of the Florida Marlins. I thought it was incredible. And but we resolved it with Gary, and when I went to the press conference, I had warned Gary. I said, Gary, when you get to the press conference, I'm going to tell them exactly how this trade came down, because I think it's important for the public to know. It's not as if I haven't made a bad trade, but if you think I'm going to go before the public and the fans and lie, you got the wrong guy. And I did announce exactly what happened, and the writers came up to me afterwards, who knew News Corp, and said, Fred, they are so kicked at you, they are going to get you, and they're going to get you quick. And they did. But the difference in ownership.
We have 10 more minutes. Now take questions from the audience. If you want to line up behind that microphone. I want to mention briefly, Dan mentioned his work with Dick in the early 80s. You know about Jed's background with the Red Sox, sabermetrics, and I know Jed is well-versed. I did want to mention, too, that Fred Clair was a big, big supporter of Craig Wright way back when Craig Wright was doing his work with club. So all these guys have been at the cutting edge on that level of baseball. Yes,
okay. I was wondering if Jed could discuss the challenges in building a team to play at Petco Park.
Given our home record, I'm not succeeding in that. But that was part of the appeal of San Diego, was having a extreme ballpark. I think that given our payroll limitations, I was kind of pound on my staff. You know, we can never talk about payroll. It can't. We have to. It's a reality of our situation. We know that. We can't use it as a crutch. We just have to accept it and make moves accordingly. I think an extreme environment, I think, allows that to happen. And I think that, you know, that's what the fun of the job is, trying to figure out a way to use this ballpark that just kills run scoring and figure out how to compete without a huge payroll. To be honest, the challenge is certainly greater than I would have imagined from the outside. I think that there's more nuances to the ballpark than I would have imagined. I think that the biggest part of the air is really the majority of it. And people ask me all the time, why don't we just move the fences in, like 30 feet? We play games at Petco when no one makes an outfielder go backwards the entire night, you know? And so that's really been interesting for me, that, you know, obviously you come in right away and you need to make moves, but I know more now about our ballpark than I did when I got there, and I think, you know, a couple years from now I'll know that much more, because it's a unique environment. There is no other place that affects run scoring quite that much. It's really the reverse of the non-humidor Coors Field. But I do think that we're getting there as far as the kind of players you need to acquire, but it's going to take time through the draft and take time through small deals to do that. But I do pound on our staff all the time, and I think they understand that everything we do has to have the ballpark in mind at some level, that whether it's in the draft or whether it's any transaction, like how this guy fits into what we want to do. You know, we have to have guys that that are athletic. You can't have a bunch of slow players out there. But at the same time, right when you think that you should get a bunch of guys that can, you know, you don't want to run the 85 Cardinals out there, because, you know, if the other team hits a two-run homer, you know, in our ballpark, it's like hitting a three or four, you know, three-run homer or a grand slam, and you have to have some ability to score runs. So finding the right balance between, you know, having a team that's built for your home ballpark, but also the ability to win on the road it's hard. But it's again, I think given our peril limitations, it's a way better method than having a neutral ballpark. I think in that case, we'd be in a lot of trouble.
Question for the panel as a whole. As a GM, what are you looking for in a manager? What do you think are the most important skills or characteristics for a manager to have?
Yeah, real quickly, I mean, I've been so fortunate with Bud Black. I think he's a terrific manager. And for me, that, you know, it sounds so cliche, but having a guy that's a leader, I mean, talk about responsibility. Every night, you know, I can slip out the back and get my car on, you know, after a given game. You know, the manager's gonna have to talk to the media every night. He's really the face of a season, if you will, night to night. You know, we had a grueling loss last night, you know, bases loaded, no one out. In the ninth inning, don't score, lose 1-0, and you know, you go down to the clubhouse right after the game, and you know, obviously players are really upset, and you know, and buddies, you know, pumping guys up, you know, put it behind you, you know, refocus. And you gotta realize that in the Major League Clubhouse, those things happen really quickly. You know, the media's in there 10 minutes after the game. Manager's not gonna say anything to the team in front of the media. So, and, you know, that's where I think leadership comes in, you know, not dwelling on what just happened, you know, setting a mood. That's really the most important thing, having a steady person. I do think that we all, part of baseball is second guessing, or really hopefully first guessing a manager. I would do this, I would do that. The way I kind of look at it is I wouldn't agree with anyone, let alone by myself. I mean, you'd probably second guess yourself. So there's not a person in the world that I could put in that job that I would agree with all the time. And I have to learn to understand that, focus on the big picture. And if generally I agree with the person's moves, if I like their leadership, if I like the way they conduct themselves, that's probably the right manager. Because you can really get caught up in each individual move. And the reality is, it doesn't matter who you put in that job, you're never going to agree with anyone all the time. As long as the process is good, as the mindset's right, I think you're probably the right person.
Anyone else want to speak to that?
I think the most difficult thing for a manager is that he's looking short term. And as a general manager, you're looking short and long. And I think one of the hardest things is you got to have a manager as a team player, because there's some moves that are made that have more long-term implications. And you know, for the guy in the dugout, that's a very difficult decision sometimes to hear and get thrust upon. I don't see many Rainier's hats here in Southern California. This is pretty impressive.
Well, that's because I'm from Seattle. So.
I follow up on what Dan said. I think today, more important than ever before, that manager who's going to have an understanding of player development and of scouting and of young players and of the relationship with the general manager is more important. That's actually been a dramatic change in the game, one of the more dramatic changes, and that's the way that it should be. And a guy that I would point to, because I knew him well, I felt that he should be the next manager of the Dodgers, is Mike Socia, because I think Mike reflects all of that, because he came through an organization. When I hired him, he went to work in the minor league department. So he understood from top to bottom, and he has shown that through the years. So there are other examples, but he clearly is one example of that.
Okay. So I wanted to just at least say that the number of Latino ball players has increased significantly over the past 3 decades. Too much so, we're now over a third of all ball players in the major leagues are Latino, and the minors are about half. So I wanted to find out, so just due to the success of the Dodgers, for example, with the academy systems, what's been your experience in working with the Latin ball players, and what is the future of Latinos in baseball, to any one of you three?
Well, I think the future is strong. I mean, and certainly with the Dodgers, that was a major part. We established one of the first really fine model academies there in the Dominican. And I think that when you look at where the talent is coming from, that in the Dominican and in Venezuela, and indeed internationally throughout the world. I mean, it's, 33% today and growing. And I don't see that trend. And there's a sad part of that, because we're not playing the game in the inner cities the way that we once played. And that's something that needs to be addressed and concerned, because we lose too many athletes. We lose too many good athletes to basketball and football and, quote, the more glamour sports in high school, that disturbs me greatly.
One thing I was going to say, too, and you know, Fred was with the Dodgers when they really had a competitive advantage on other teams. I think the Dodgers and the Blue Jays were the pioneers in the Dominican and got a head start. You know, now you have a situation where you have 30 teams that have a presence in the Dominican. So, in general, I think that certainly it's a huge part, a huge source of talent for baseball. But the days of sort of having that leg up, I mean, that's not going to happen again. And there'll be another, place where someone will get a huge competitive advantage. But right now, in Latin America, there's too many teams going after too few players for any one team to have sort of a noticeable difference, where Toronto and LA had a huge advantage for a long time.
I think the mistake we make, though, as a game is we don't have the same patience level with the Latino players as we do with a lot of American players. And if you think about it, we sign the Latin players at a younger age. They have the barrier of language, yet we expect them to matriculate to the big leagues at the same rate as the American players, and that's just not right. And I have been a proponent of that for years. I think with patience, a lot of really good Dominican, Venezuelan players become really good big league players if you just hang with them. Maglio Ordóñez is the best example for me. Everybody in the room one year in the White Sox, when he was in the minor leagues, wanted to let him go except one, and that was Dwight Evans. And Dwight Evans said, "Danny, this guy's gonna hit. I have no doubt." And we all said, "Dwight Evans, he's 155 pounds. He said, "Have you seen his dad?" And I think part of the problem for you in the room is you don't realize what these guys have to go through on a daily basis that makes every day so much tougher than the kid who woke up every day in Southern California as a kid.
We have time for one more question, and then the buzz will load.
Great, thanks. Can you give us a little behind the scenes as to what happens the 2 weeks before the trade deadline in terms of, is it all telephone? Do you use a lot of email now? Do you send out mass emails to all the GMs? Do you target individual GMs? Can you give us a sense of what that process is like as we're getting into that season?
Sure. All the time, I think, we always talk about sort of constant preparedness, so having scouting reports on everyone, multiple looks, and that's really important, so that, if someone calls and proposes a deal in the middle of May, you can't just say, well, hey, I'll get back to you in July when we just cover your system. But as you get into July, you get a feel for the teams that are going to be interested in your players, or if you're a buyer, the teams that you'll be interested in trading with, and you kind of narrow that down as much as you can, and then try to send as many scouts in as possible. Really try to research every player that you may try to acquire, or really try to research if you're like last year as a buyer, really trying to research the teams that were selling and getting a feel for what they're going to do. It's a fascinating challenge because you're really trying to put together a puzzle. Teams have different interests, different needs. You're trying to put a puzzle together. Things change dramatically week to week. All of a sudden, team wins 7 in a row. They're not, okay, that guy you're targeting, now they're not a seller anymore. Now they're a buyer. And so it really shifts constantly. But to me, the biggest thing is casting a wide net, sending out a lot of scouts, making sure that you do your workup on every player that is a possibility. And I mean, everybody's going to get whittled down dramatically, and then hopefully at the end you'll have a couple of deals that you can possibly make. But it's the most fun month of the year. You always want to be on the buy side of that transaction. You don't want to be on the sell side. But either way, it's a month where you can dramatically change your team's fortunes if you make good deals. If you make a good deal, you can end up in the playoffs and the World Series. And make a good deal on the sell side, you can set yourself up for a good future. And I really think every GM looks at it that way. This is the most important month for us as far as deal making. And then obviously December is important, but really I always think of July as that's the month you have to shine and be focused and get as much information as possible.
We need to cut it off there. I want to thank everybody, Dan, Fred. I really feel awful right now. But we'll all miss it.
We have Sheffield, Isaiah's from Sheffield, Chris McGriff, McGuinn, we might not win, but it'll be a lot of fun.
Plus our challenge. You know, we haven't, the team hasn't developed any hitters, you know, and that's really my challenge, to develop an offense. And, you know, really, if you think, you go back and think about it, it's been, you know, Adrian was a brilliant three.
Right.
And, but, you know, other than that, there really haven't been, most of the good offensive players have been and veteran players that we picked up. You know, we've got, I guess, a point we draft well and develop. And
you have right-handed power there.
Yeah, if you get you right-handed, then you're every guy with a slider is going to kill you. You know? So, I mean, that's the biggest challenge, is that you got a ballpark that kills lefties.
Right.
But try building a team around right-hand hitters and you're dead.
Really?
You can't do it.
Right.
You can't do it.
The question I have is that when you make a trade, the real question is, one of the things I've seen is how does the new guy really, how will the new guy impact the team?
Right.
Okay, does he really help you win how many more games? So what are you looking for? Can you use that
analysis? Yeah, I could look at how much. You start breaking down moves into how much they impact. Like,
right.
You make a move at the deadline. Let's say you acquire a 4-win player at the deadline.
Right.
You know, it's pretty sobering how much that player is going to affect it. And that's like a reliever at the deadline. He might appear in 20 more games, and that's it's a fraction of a win.
Right.
So you can think about that, and it helps rein you in.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you start analyzing every move like that, you're never going to do anything, so you think it's worthless.
Well, that's
so
right.
I think that's a challenge. Is that, you know, I mean, think about last year. I mean, I still feel really good about getting hot and muddled at the deadline. I needed to improve offense. But the reality is, any move like that at the deadline, it can only have impact. It can only have so much impact.
Unless the guy just takes off.
Unless the guy just takes off. And that, you never know. And when a guy changes teams, you have guys. I mean, frankly, I think Tejada is actually a good example.
Yeah.
He got the most out of him, I think, given what he's doing this year. But you don't know. He could have come in. Hank Ludwig came in and knew his struggle.
Right.
There's no way to know how a guy's going to come in. You know, when I was in Boston, we had Eric Gagne, I think
20 for 22,
23 save situations when we got him, low ERA. He actually came in our place and dominated us. We pitched for him, and he almost cost us a World Series, you know? And there's just no way to predict how that's going to happen. It just, some guys do better with that change of scenery. Doesn't affect some guys, it does affect other guys. And if you can find a way to figure out how to do that, no one I've ever talked to knows.
I think what happens is, I think what you were saying, you have to develop young players.
Exactly.
It really goes there, and that's really going to be the mark of the team. And then you bring in the player that you think can help.
With our payroll, I mean, realistically, you're going to acquire players, like external players. So you're not going to have, like, you're basically taking the pool of players and you're selecting here. You know, so if you can make individual moves here and there with veteran players that are on the market, but you're selecting from, you know, near the bottom of that group.
Sure.
So you can only do so well. I mean, ultimately, the only way to really win in San Diego is with young, homegrown players.
So
the only way to do it. As long as our payroll is in that bottom barrel.
Now, we're from Philadelphia.
That's right.
Okay, Philadelphia sells out every game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How much more money does it make? How much difference does it make if you add 10,000 to each game? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Does it make a big difference? Or is it?
It makes a huge difference.
Is it okay?
Absolutely. I don't work in business. I couldn't tell you exactly what 10,000 per game is. But, I mean, look at them. I always think about it. Look at the Phillies. I mean, they're second baseman and first baseman. That's our payroll.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, they're starting pitcher and their first baseman. That's our payroll.
Right. But is it worth it? Is it worth it?
Absolutely.
So do they make money?
What's that?
Do they?
Absolutely. So is Red Sox.
Let's just say, for instance, you did the same thing with the Padres. Would they make money?
The difference in local team.
Okay.
That's the biggest difference. I mean,
right.
You know, if you sell every night, that's great. And I mean, the Cardinals are probably the best example.
Okay.
They sell at every bit. Virtually every game, they have a ridiculous
40,000
for a small metro area.
Right.
But if you look at it, they're probably at about 100 million.
Sure, I have.
But they don't have a grade, okay, but not grade level team. Okay. So, but they take it into the Phillies, or the Red Sox, or the Yankees. Their local team is so big, they can have barrels, $180 million,
and it's fine.
So that extra, making this up, but that extra 70, that's what they do. And that's what's not going to happen.
Oh, really? But the rumor is that it could happen.
Well, I think we'll get a better cable deal, but it's not going to be Nestle. It's not going to be Yes. It's not going to be
a Binder's deal. He's like, I'll do that. Contrast it now.
No, it'll be a better deal. It's not going to be like the Rangers just got a couple $1 billion because Dallas is such a big area. So they're going to, their payroll went from whatever, 50 or 60 to 100. And I don't think we can expect that kind of increase because the area of San Diego is going to warm it like NASA. A deal that's going to increase our payroll to 100 million.
Tijuana, you can't get over there.
No one's for that, yeah.
Right.
That was one of the things Theo told me when I came over. I'm just telling you right now. So I've been hearing that since 96.
Right.
No one's managed to do it yet, so he's like,
I've been there since 86.
If someone can figure out the next that market, God bless them, but it's not, everything, Keno started getting to that market in the mid-90s and never did.
Right.
So, I don't know. We made the best
Knicks player of all time.
Right. And didn't affect the tenants.
Right.
Did it?
I don't know.
You looked like you.
For a while we were okay when we were.
That's because we were winning.
Right.
The last year.
Right.
Yeah. That team last year. Right. We drew 15,000-16,000 last weekend. Yeah. Last week of the season. Yeah. They three playing first base. So yeah. That's the one thing
I'll tell you what.
I hope it doesn't happen. I hope that.
Do you think it matters if it's downtown?